Other things you might want to consider other than medications, which aren't necessarily solving any problems, is could you consider in the early stages of Alzheimer's just using some of those external strategies, putting notes on the fridge, putting notes around the stove, reminders everywhere. And that's what caregivers are told to do. In the early stages, these patients will be able to read and do what the instruction says to do. We often do want to assess whether they should still be driving, and that's a big fight with patients. They're like, if you take away their driving, you take away their independence, and that's a huge struggle. But at the same time, we also know that they might not be safe drivers because they can't interpret road signs. They don't know reverse versus second gear, so it's an issue. And then the fact that they do tend to get lost or spatially confused, they wander, and they can't find their way home. We do have a national program in the United States to help return. You have a bracelet on, you have some sort of ID on, that if you are found and you don't know how to get home, we'll be able to get you home. Now, there's just something that Germany has done. It's hard to see, but this is a nursing home, and there's a bench in front of the nursing home and a bus stop sign. It's fake. It's a fake bus stop sign. So the patients who think, it's time to go home, I have to get to work, I got to catch the bus, they go and sit there. And then staff comes out and say, oh, the bus driver just called. He's going to be about 10 minutes late. Let me make you a cup of tea while we wait. And then you talk to them, have your cup of tea, and then they forgot that they wanted to go. And then you get them back into the residence, and you've just saved them from trying to break away and run away and get lost. Okay. Other things to consider is that caregivers are burned out. Caregivers are stressed. They're angry, they're bitter, they're resentful because they're giving care year after year after year after year. It's thankless care, and it's care that ultimately is not going to help. It's not like a child where I'll get through this phase because I know my child will grow up and will be better. And this is a person who's not going to get better. They're only getting worse, and all their efforts are emotionally draining, financially draining, and this can result in depression, elder abuse. It can result in a lot of devastation for the caregiver. And again, if it becomes abusive, then we got a legal issue on our hands. There are a tremendous number of resources available for loved ones that have Alzheimer's in their family. And a lot of it is even tips. For example, what do I do when my wife thinks that there's a snake on her? And I say, there's no snake. Do you do that? Do you try to reality orient them? Do you try to reality orient them? And the answer is usually no. And even see staff members in Alzheimer's units will say, the snake, look, go away, snake, go away, snake. Oh, did you see the snake slithered away? It's gone now, you're okay. Okay. Versus trying to say there was no snake. Yes, there is. No, there's not. Arguing's not likely going to help. Duncan, he's old and demented. And he's all of a sudden saying, oh, I got to get to work, I got to get to work, I got to go teach neuro. And no. I already talked to Dr. Burkhart, and you're covered for today. You've got the day off. No worries. And he's been retired or fired 10 years ago, whatever it's been. And you don't argue with them. You don't try to reality orient them. It just causes distress. You're sitting in the park with your grandma. Oh, isn't that a lovely sound of a waterfall? It's traffic, grandma. It's traffic. And what? Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just say, yeah, isn't that a lovely sound? So the idea is don't turn these incidences into dramas that they don't need to be. Okay, actually, for the interest of time, I can post that one, and then we'll move on to part two. Oh, actually, someone had asked, I didn't want to address this. Why glutamate receptor blockers for Alzheimer's? The rationale is that these plaques that are forming in the brain are like pebbles that have been thrown in your brain. They're like mini brain injuries. And what does the brain do oftentimes after a stroke, after a traumatic brain injury? Releases glutamate. That's not good because glutamate's excitotoxic, and now you've got neurons firing excessively and dying. So the concern is even after stroke, after traumatic brain injury, that there's injury that continues to go on even after the incident because of this glutamate release. Now, if these plaques are the same thing, and as you're advancing in your disease, more and more and more and more plaques, then you've got a whole lot many more pebbles being thrown in your brain, each one acting as if it's a head injury. And if you're excessively releasing glutamate, it's not helping. So block glutamate. that was the rationale for why that might be more helpful for the advanced stages when you've got more of these plaques in the brain. Right, once you establish or you think you have Alzheimer's, what should be other considerations and how would you rule them out? Well, one consideration is you're having little strokes and it's a vascular etiology and not Alzheimer's. Well, what would be suggestive that you're having little strokes? What would be indicative that you've got vascular disease? What would be in the history? High blood pressure, high cholesterol, you're a smoker, you're overweight. I mean, you just have the things that suggest that you're probably at risk for a heart attack. The same thing, your risk for having cerebral vascular problems. But to me, I would want to know more than that, because it still could be Alzheimer's, is the progression of the symptoms. We said by default, Alzheimer's is slowly progressive, gradual progression. So if this is 100% capacity of our cognitive abilities, slow, gradual. If I'm having strokes, then what would you expect? I'm functioning and then stroke. And I plummet. And they'll say, it's Sunday, it got worse. And then I plateau because I'm not stroking anymore. Until I stroke again because the underlying vascular problems aren't being addressed. So you do hear about this stepwise progression. So from the history, from relatives, it's tell me about the progression. Does it plateau and then get worse suddenly and plateau, or is it just constant, gradual? When I hear that stepwise, that no, it plateaus and then suddenly gets worse and plateaus and suddenly worse, then I think vascular. And that would be another piece of the puzzle indicating to me more vascular etiology. Also, if you went through a neurological exam and say, geez, your left hand's really weak, your right hand's really weak, you don't see that kind of asymmetry in Alzheimer's. That's more focal, I would be thinking again vascular. Headache, again, indicating probably more vasoconstriction, vasodilation issues. And the strokes often leave scar tissue, and scar tissue tends to be epileptogenic. So again, indicators that might be more vascular. Ultimately, the treatments know better as far as stopping the memory problems that might be associated with it, but at least we can perhaps treat, if we recognize you have a vascular problem, vascular disease, and we control your blood pressure, control your cholesterol, control your weight, and hopefully you plateau and don't have another decline. Frontotemporal dementia, or FTDs, PICS is one example of an FTD, is one I'm more familiar with. This is one that does have a little bit earlier age of onset than Alzheimer's, but what you're really focusing on here is that it's frontotemporal. We said that in Alzheimer's, it's usually more prominent temporal parietal, it's more posterior. This is one where early on, you're seeing a lot of frontal lobe symptoms. What suggests frontal lobes involved early? What are symptoms of prefrontal lobe damage? Being childlike, being disinhibited, being lewd, crude. And you'll hear that the family members say, I don't care that he forgot that he told me the same story 3 times today. I care that he's grabbing my breast in public. I'm concerned that he's pulling down his pants in public. I'm concerned that he's eating like a pig. I'm concerned that he's hypersexual. I'm concerned that he's telling dirty jokes in a context that's really not appropriate. They will comment more on the disinhibition, the childlike personality change that occurs. So that's usually the presenting complaint from family, is more the personality change, the disinhibition. And then if you were to do scans, you should probably see then more problems with frontal lobe involved earlier than you would expect in Alzheimer's. Now, does the frontal lobe get involved in Alzheimer's? Absolutely. Everything ultimately gets involved in Alzheimer's. But early on in a dementing process, you wouldn't expect so much frontal involvement in Alzheimer's, but more so in FTD. And ultimately, if you wanted to confirm, for example, if PICS was your FTD, that there are changes that microscopically you could say, yes, they've got these PICC bodies. We know that this is then more indicative of an FTD. Okay, so frontal is your clue. LBD, Lewy body dementia, looking for some cardinal features. One of the cardinal features is they are compromised in their memory and their word finding. And so they're looking Alzheimer's-ish. but they're fluctuating much more on a day-to-day basis. Alzheimer's, I don't expect grandma to look different today from yesterday, from tomorrow. You're kind of just the same, but slowly you're getting worse. In FTD, in LBD, you expect, geez, you are really not so bad today. And then 2 days later, geez, they look like they're near death. And then, oh, not so bad again. So they do in LBD have much more change. It will get worse over time, but much more fluctuation on a day-to-day basis. Early in the disorder, visual hallucinations. People and animals usually are the content, and they don't speak. So the cat's not meowing, and the person that ran in with the dagger in their hand isn't speaking either. So it's visual, but usually very quiet. So usually not auditory. No auditory stimulus with that. And usually not bothersome to them. Oh, there's a person sitting on the street. They're in a sailor outfit. There's no one there. Okay. I mean, these don't seem to be upset by what they see. And then the third classic sign is that they do show some motor symptoms. It looks Parkinson-like, and it very is related to Parkinson's disease, but it's milder than in Parkinson's, and usually you'd have the rigidity, and you would have the shuffling gait, but usually you don't. The tremors are very unlikely. Again, confirmation histopathologically. If we think it's Lewy body, there's Lewy bodies that would help confirm that if you could sample their tissue. Another indicator of LBD is what we talked about under sleep disorders, where the person is in REM. They should be atonic, but they're not, which means when they go into REM and have their visual imagery, they're dreaming, that they very well will have vocalizations, they'll have motor movements when they should be atonic. And that's why we were concerned that if someone really had this REM sleep behavior disorder, say diagnosed in their 40s, we're worried that ultimately you're going to be an LBD patient or even a Parkinson's patient. So Lewy body dementia, we're looking at those three symptoms, the fluctuating mental status, the visual hallucinations, and the Parkinsonism that's mild. Now, one thing to note about LBD is that you think, well, they're visually hallucinating. Don't we want to treat that? You could. You can give them an antipsychotic. But the problem is they tend to have quite a sensitive reaction to antipsychotics. They're more likely to have tardive dyskinesia, dystonia, akathisia, all those things that we already talked about as a side effect of our antipsychotics and the neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So they are considered so exquisitely sensitive to the neuroleptics that they're advised to wear an ID bracelet that says, do not give me an antipsychotic because it's going to cause me perhaps great motor problems. So it's considered like an allergy. So if we can't give them an antipsychotic, then the idea would be, what do we do? Well, the hallucinations they have aren't distressful to them. Yeah, this guy ran in, he was masked, he had a gun, and then he went into the bedroom and left. Okay. They're not really freaked out by this. They're not upset by it. So why not just leave it alone? So benign neglect is usually the suggestion is let them have their visual hallucinations. It's not that distressful to them. If they have the motor symptoms that are mild, can't we give them our dopamine agonist? Can we give them carbidopa? Can we give them something to boost their dopamine to help with their motor movements? You can. But unlike in Parkinson's, the L-DOPA type drugs don't tend to really help their mild symptoms. And as we try to increase their dopamine, and it's not really helping their motor, what are we doing? Potentially making their psychotic symptoms work because of that delicate balance between motor and psychosis. So then they're suggesting, well, why don't we just let them live with their mild symptoms then? Because if we try to boost their dopamine, probably it's not helping their motor, and then we're making their psychosis work. So implications of that specific diagnosis. Parkinson's disease, motor disease. They say 40 to 50% of people that have the motor disease will dement. So it's not a certainty by any means, but a good number will. And sometimes, geez, that looks like LBD. And there is a lot of similarities between Lewy body dementia and a Parkinson's dementia. So because of the overlap, the suggestion is this is how we're going to label you. If you have motor symptoms and motor symptoms alone for at least a year, you're bona fide Parkinson's patient, and then develop cognitive problems, well, then you're Parkinson's with a dementia. But what if the dementia is early on? What if the dementia is at the same time as the motor or kind of precedes it or postcedes it, but it's in that first year? Well, we're saying dementia seems to be the problem here, and we're going to call it a Lewy body dementia. So not just Parkinson's with dementia, we're going to call that, in that case, Lewy body dementia. And I don't know if this helps or not, but looking at the one-year rule, Parkinson's disease dementia is only going to be diagnosed if motor happened first and alone in the first year. And then at some future point, somewhere down the line, but after your year, they're demented. That is when you're going to get PDD, okay, Parkinson's disease dementia. Any other permutation, it's going to be LBD. So the key here is motor and dementia simultaneously, dementia and motor, whatever order, or dementia by itself and then motor. And the key here is dementia is happening in the first year. If dementia is happening in the first year, it's LBD. That's the one-year rule. But overlap between the two diagnoses. Huntington's disease almost always will end up in a dementia. But in this case, Huntington's, being the motor disorder, will be obvious because they will have the choreiform and the athetoid motor movements. They often have prominent psychiatric problems. They have psychotic depression. And this will precede the dementia. So it wouldn't be any surprise that it's a Huntington's disease dementia because you've already been diagnosed with Huntington's. And then you have to consider prion-related diseases. Prion-related diseases, CJD or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, is a classic example of a prion disease. And I don't even think about this as a possibility unless I hear a greatly accelerated course. So this isn't 10 years, this isn't 6 years, this is 6 months from being absolutely normal to being globally demented and on deathbed. And I've known one person that had this, a neuroscientist that had this happen. We saw him speak at a conference, brilliant talk, and then 6 months later, we were told, scientific community, he was dead from CJD. So it is there, it's a possibility, it's rare, but you don't even think about it unless it's that accelerated of a course. And of course, in your differentials, think about what other things that might be going on that could be rectifiable. Oh, interesting. What was that? For all of these disorders, what symptoms do you have to play with? Right now, all you know is that it's 1 year, so you know it's early on. You know it's gradual progression, and as soon as you hear gradual progression, what do you probably eliminate? Vascular. There's no mention of motor, so no mention of motor probably would get rid of Parkinson's and Huntington's. The fact that it's been a year and he's still walking around says it's probably not a prion problem. It's probably not CJD. You really only have someone that's gradually progressing in memory and language, but prominent in that first year is a lot of frontal lobe signs, behavioral change. That's more suggestive of the frontotemporal PICS disease type of problem. So vascular ruled out because it's not stepwise. Okay, don't have motor. So eliminate several. Lewy body would come to mind if you had, again, you had to have some motor, some fluctuating cognition, and visual hallucinations. So other differentials. Elderly people who are depressed, they're going to complain about memory and attention. And they're 70 years old. If you're 70 complaining of memory and attention, I'm going to think dementia. But memory and attention can be compromised if you're depressed. So you might need to try to figure out, is the attention and memory problems they're complaining about related to the fact they're depressed, or is there a dementing process going on? So pseudo-dementia is the term that's usually used to talk about someone who is depressed but showing memory problems. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Another differential is maybe, because I've worked with a number of patients who come forward, and the question is benign senescent forgetfulness or Alzheimer's. And the idea is, you know that memory declines with age. Most skills decline with age, and some people are sensitive to that, and they get worried about it, and they come forward and say, I think I'm losing it. Well, they might be, or they're just showing normal decline in cognitive function, and they're keeping up with their peers. So it's not dementia, it's just normal age-related decline. And that's usually part of the differential as well. And again, we'll mention that in a few minutes. DSM. The terms I've used, delirium, amnesia, dementia, neurology terms. DSM-5. Used to use these terms. DSM-5 decided we don't like the term dementia. And they got rid of it. And they got rid of the term amnesia. And instead now, you can still diagnose delirium, as before, but now your only diagnosis is NCD. What's your problem? NCD. You have an aphasia? NCD. You have an amnesia? NCD. You have Alzheimer's? NCD. It's just all NCD. And the only thing you can distinguish is it major or mild? And that's just functional impairment. That's just, are you really compromised or not really compromised? But it doesn't tell you which symptoms. It doesn't tell you how many symptoms. It just, as long as you have a cognitive realm impaired, language, memory, visual, spatial, whatever it is, one area gets you NCD. And then if it's interfering with your activities of daily living, then it's major. And if it's not so problematic, mild. Now, what DSM does allow you to do is be more specific in the sense that once you say they have NCD, you can say due to. Now, if you say NCD due to Alzheimer's, I kind of get the idea, dementia. If I say NCD due to vascular disease, I guess I'm not quite sure if it's dementia or what, but at least you can specify the etiology. Okay, what I'm trying to emphasize here is you've got patients in the same functional impairment state, correct? They both have compromise to their activities of daily living due to some sort of cognitive problem. So they both, because in both cases that the deficits interfere with their ADLs, they have to be what kind of NCD? Has to be major. Patient A, or patient 1 and patient 2, same compromise state. They can't do their ADLs, so they're both major. But patient number 1 only has one symptom, and patient number 2 has multiple symptoms. Does it change DSM's diagnosis? Nope, it's still just NCD. What would we say in neurology for patient 1 if you only have a deficit in memory? Okay. We would say you have an amnesia. Second case, we would say dementia. But again, DSM has changed. I'm not sure if they'll revert back at some point, but I think the terms dementia and amnesia will stay forever used, just not necessarily by DSM. So just I've provided you a comparison of how DSM might work versus the rest of the world in the way they talk about these type of cognitive problems. How do we assess whether someone has a neurocognitive disorder? Well, this is the world of neuropsych testing. I mentioned this earlier in the week under psych testing, is neuropsych testing is a way of trying to figure out what may be going on with brain functioning and whether, for example, a dementia is being experienced. So neuropsych testing is usually 8 hours, even 2 days worth of testing in which we are belaboring assessing your memory and attention, visual, spatial, and executive, and we're trying to now make an inference about how's your parietal lobe doing? How's your temporal lobe doing? How's your frontal lobe doing based on these tests? And then we try to figure out normal aging, dementia, what type of dementia? We talked about IQ tests already. IQ tests are usually part of a neuropsych battery. It's just one piece of evidence. We want to know your IQ. We want to know if your IQ is compatible with your educational background. And even within the IQ test, keep in mind that there's a lot of visual tests and a lot of verbal tests. What if you're really bad at verbal and really good at visual? Is that telling me something about brain functioning? Yeah, probably talking about one hemisphere over the other. If verbal's bad, I'm probably more worried about left hemisphere. If visual's really bad, then I'm probably more worried about right hemisphere. So even our intelligence test can give us neuropsych information. It tells something about hemispheric functioning. And even more specifically, not just right or left, but geez, that's looking more right temporal or right parietal. So even performance on an IQ test can give us some indication of parts of the brain and how they're functioning. Attention. A visual attention test might be, here's a bunch of rows of numbers. I want you to cross out all the fours as fast as you can. And you might see how fast they are to complete the test. You're going to look for if they're making commission errors, like crossing out the wrong ones. And we can see how is attention doing and compare you to people your age on this test. A verbal attention test. Oh, sorry, I'll get to that sec. Another visual attention test is if you are asked to, as fast as you can, connect the numbers. So one, two, there. And how well can I visually scan? Am I making errors? So again, another visual attention test. Verbal attention, this is a really challenging one. You have an audio recording of numbers said right one after the other, and you have to do some adding. So you would say here, 3, 5, and what do you say? 8. You quickly forget 8. You hear the next number on the tape that says 2, and then you add the 2 that you just heard to the number you heard on the tape, not what you just said. That's hard to do, because if I just said 8 and you said 2, I'm going to be adding it to what I just said, but you don't. So in this case, the answer, the next thing you're supposed to say is 7. Purge the 7. You hear the next number? Okay, but on the spot, that's kind of challenging. It keeps coming after you. You really have to pay attention and suppress. Okay. So those are just examples of, and again, 8 hours worth of these kind of tests. Memory tests. Dr. Blackman gave you a feel for what these might be like, but you might be read, and this is what I would do so many times. 16 words, I read it to you. What do you recall? Let me do it again. I read you the 16 words. Let me do it again. You do it 5 times. And you want to see a learning curve. You want to see that with each repetition, they're getting more and more information in. And then you wait 20 minutes. You wait, and then you say, what do you remember? So it's really getting at encoding and consolidation. And then when they can't, then you say, okay, if they didn't get the complete list, you say, well, how many of them were? And you give them hints. You give them clues. And does that help facilitate pulling up your memory? So that's a verbal memory test. Visual, you'd be given 10 seconds. And you look at it for 10 seconds, and then you take it away, you draw it. You see it for 10 seconds, take it away, you draw it. 10 seconds, take it away, draw it. So you can imagine working with people that already are suspecting that they're declining, potentially, and you're giving them just this barrage of test. Now, one thing that is usually quite helpful is, especially after I say, here's these 16 words, what do you remember? And then they'll come up with a few words. If you give them hints, well, some of them were desserts. Some of them were fruits. And it helps. Oh, yes. And all of a sudden they get more right. It's telling you a little bit more about where the problem is in their memory. Is it a matter of the fact that the information didn't get in? Or was it more of a problem just pulling it back out? And if you give hints and someone still says, I don't know. Hints, I still don't know. That means it didn't get in. That's an encoding problem. It did not get in. Versus, oh, 20 minutes later, and they say some more desserts, and they're like, oh, it was this, and they get a whole bunch more that says the information did get in, but it's not getting pulled out. And when we talk about retrieval and encoding, usually we're thinking temporal, hippocampal. If cues are helping, we think, oh, frontal lobe isn't helping to pull up. So we usually talk about cueing, if it helps. It's just a more of a retrieval problem, and it might be more frontal lobe mediated. If cueing doesn't help, it didn't get in, the information didn't get encoded, then it's probably more of a temporal lobe issue. Language, part of a neuropsych eval would be, I want to see how well you name things. I would want to see how well you can search your lexicon and tell me as many words that you can think of that start with the letter and say it was A. Go, and you get 1 minute. Apple, that one. And there are rules, like you can't say eating. You get 1 credit for that. You don't get permutations of the same word. But overall, we know that over 3 trials, it's about 40 words you should be able to generate. That's expected to be able to generate that. And then that's phonemic. That's supposed to be more frontal lobe involved. We think that people that don't do well on that's more frontal lobe issue. Versus, how about if I give you a concrete semantic category? Name as many animals, vegetables, whatever it is, and then you compare. How do you do on the phonemic compared to how do you do on the more semantic? And that might say, oh, frontal's worse than temporal because the category more involves, is thought to be more of a temporal lobe issue. So anyway, we use this information to try to make some inferences about what part of the brain might be working well and not so well. Visual, spatial, just plain old copying. The stimulus is there, and all you have to do is reproduce it. So you can have lots of different symbols, just plain old copying. Another classic visual spatial test you'll probably do bedside if you want to quickly say, how's your visual spatial functioning? Draw a clock. I would like you to draw the face of a clock, put the numbers on it, and make the time say, you know, the hands of the clock say in a particular time. So in each of these examples up here, they're not setting the hands to 4:45. They're not necessarily even putting the numbers on the clock correctly. And when they can't do that kind of spatial task, we say that's visual spatial, and it's more indicative of right hemisphere, right parietal specifically even, problems. Okay. Executive functions, looking at how well we can abstract. Okay. We don't want you to be concrete, we want you to abstract. So we would give you proverbs. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. What does that mean? How are two things alike? Executive function prefrontal would also be, remember that task in this that you just did where you connected the numbers. This is where you have to alternate one and then a letter, A, two, B. And again, your time, do you see how many errors you make? This can be very challenging for many different kind of patients, but where you have to pay attention, but you have to alternate set. An alternating set is often part of a frontal lobe skill. Wisconsin cards are, we talked about when we talked about psychotic disorders, where you have to match the center card to one of the exterior stimuli, and then based on whether I say right or wrong, change your set. Don't just keep doing the same thing. Don't perseverate. Change your set. change your strategy. And then you've heard, you, Dr. Blackman showed you the Stroop test earlier in the semester, again, a prefrontal lobe skill. We also look at motor functions, and when we as a neuropsychologist do it, is we want to look at quickness and dexterity. And we want to see how fast you can put in pegs one at a time in sequence. Left hand, same thing. And what we're really interested in, whether we're doing putting pegs in a hole, or how fast you can, how many times can I tap this lever in 10 seconds? And then another trial, how many taps can I tap this lever in 10 seconds? And then I do my other hand. I want to compare my dominant hand with all of your dominant hands. I want to compare my non-dominant hand with your non-dominant hand. If there's no difference between my hemispheres, I shouldn't show much of a discrepancy. If I'm 50th percentile with my dominant, I should be 50th percentile with my non-dominant. But if I'm showing a big difference, what that's saying? Something has happened more unilaterally. And if it's happening more unilaterally, that's more, again, suggestive of a stroke, more so than an Alzheimer's problem where you wouldn't see that type of issue. I have no idea why this is doing, but I'll get to them here. Somehow the images got cut off a little bit, but hopefully what you're trying to ascertain by the actual copying task and the draw a clock task, what do you say? Are those skills pretty good? The copying is good. They set the time right. So that's more visual spatial. That's kind of right parietal. Right parietal seems not obviously problematic at this point. But if you did visual memory, it seems like they're doing very poorly on visual memory. So the fact that it's visual probably indicates right hemisphere, that it's memory, probably temporal. So this would probably be suggestive of a more of a right temporal problem. Now, of course, So again, just based on the fact that visual spatial tasks considered more right parietal, memories, we're thinking more temporal, and it's visual, so it's more right hemisphere. But in a neuropsych eval, you would have a lot of different tests. You wouldn't make any sort of judgment based on just a handful of tests. Well, this would be more encoding. So if we're just getting the memories in, wouldn't be so if they got it in and then couldn't retrieve it later on, I'd be thinking more frontal. But this is just getting the information in right away. So that's more of an encoding. So in the world of neuropsych, again, a popular question is normal aging or dementia? And we have, for all these types of tests, data that says, for an 80-year-old, this is how most 80-year-olds perform. And we can assess you and say, for your age, despite your concerns about what you are experiencing in life, your skills are at the 85th percentile. You're actually above one standard deviation above the mean. You're not dementing. Normal age-related changes. We can watch, but there's no indication that this person's actually losing ground. And that can be reassuring for a lot of people who are concerned about the more minor and trivial changes that occur with age. As I mentioned earlier, finding out whether someone who's elderly is dementing or maybe it's part of a depression, some of the things you might look at. If I was dealing with an older person that came to me and they're, yeah, my memory's bad, my attention's bad. When did it start? 2 months ago. Okay, you'd never say that with Alzheimer's. What do you say with Alzheimer's? I don't know, a year, two, six, it's more vague. So the more precise, then it sounds more like a pseudo-dementia. By the time someone with Alzheimer's comes to see you, it will have gone on for a while. It'll be a year, maybe two, or I'm not quite sure, but it's a more lengthy time. Someone with depression, chances are, given how long depressive episodes last, it's not going to be years it has been going on. They'll say, oh, it's going to be relatively short duration by the time they will come to see you. With Alzheimer's, when they make mistakes and they do another test, they'll make mistakes, and it'll be consistent. You do badly on this verbal memory test, you do badly on that verbal memory test. There shouldn't be that much variability. Why would there be in dementia? Effort, motivation, they're depressed, they're not putting forth their full effort, so you see much more variability in their performance. The Alzheimer's patient is one that will say, I've done this before where I've read that list of 16 words, and they'll come up and they'll say, well, how many can you remember? And they'll come up with three, and they'll know that that's not good out of 16. And they'll be like, oh, it was your accent. And they were like blaming me for why they couldn't recall, because I said, instead of crayon, I said crayon or something. I said the word funny. But it was, again, blame, not my fault. Whereas someone who's depressed, remember, they've got that negative mindset. Look, see, I told you things are terrible for me. Look how impaired I am. They'd be more one to highlight it, draw attention to it. You've heard over and over again, in Alzheimer's, it's an encoding, it's a consolidation issue. Cues are not going to help them. You can cue them all you want. But depressed people, if they're not coming up with the words because they're just not really fully searching their lexicon, guess what? If you give them a hint that, oh yeah, some were fruits, some were spices, some were tools, oh, and then they'll tend to help their memory. So cues would help in a pseudo-dementia and a depression. Alzheimer's patients tend to answer it. They'll say, what's 16 and 16? 35. They'll give you an answer. It'll be wrong. Depressed people, I don't know. It's like they don't want to put forth the cognitive effort. So these are just little things that you might look for that suggest Alzheimer's versus a pseudo-dementia. Another possibility, another referral question is, in the common, since vascular is a viable explanation for dementia, what might I look for? Well, in the world of Alzheimer's, we said encoding. Vascular dementia kind of depends on where their strokes are, but it's likely not a stroke right in the hippocampus. So chances are that they will probably get memories in, and it's more of an issue pulling them up if they're showing memory problems. And as I mentioned, you're going to see much more lateralizing signs, like poor dexterity, poor speed with one hand compared to the other. So the lateralizing. Oh, sorry. I don't know why this is being problematic. So hopefully, based on what we discussed here, we're looking at an older person. Question is pseudo-dementia or something like an Alzheimer's going on. What suggests that this actually is probably more part of a depression? One is when did the problem start? It was more precise 6 months ago. There was a stressor. Seems like he has got some symptoms. The inconsistency in his performance, the fact that cues help his performance, the fact that he gives up early, those are all suggestive that it might be more of a depression going on in this case. And I have given you a chart that tries to emphasize the major differences between the dementias, so have a look at those. And then we'll do one last one and call it a morning. Oh, I probably need to. Oh, no, it's working. for all of these, a lot of these diagnoses, you need to see additional symptoms, not just the fact that they have memory and language problems. You need motor, you need more frontal lobe behavioral changes. All you know is they've got the classic memory language functions. Alzheimer's should be the first thing that comes to mind. The next thing I would think about, could it be vascular? But I say no vascular. Why? Because it's gradual. Okay, so I'd rule out gradual in that case. Okay, the other ones, Creutzfeldt-Jakob would be faster. Okay. Huntington's, Parkinson's has to have motor. What does Lewy body need? Lewy body has memory problems. They got word-finding problems. Visual hallucinations, I need some motor, and I'd need some more fluctuation going on. And if it was frontotemporal, I got to hear a lot about the behavioral personality in disinhibition problems. All right, have a great afternoon. I will have a see you tomorrow for IMCQ.